Now, I know what you're thinking. What kind of person looks at all that text and thinks, you know what we need? More to read. But I feel like these are parables that are, you know, repeated often. We read them a lot. I mean, maybe not all of us are as familiar with them, but they're like popular in the sense of, like, as far as biblical literature is concerned, they're like more commonly known than not. And something that isn't as commonly known is the Book of Enoch. So I want to read a section for, like, several sections from the Book of Enoch that kind of, I think, shed light on the reading in Matthew. I'll talk more specifically about the context of Enoch after we read. But I left pieces of paper for, like, visual learners who prefer to read instead of hear something said. Okay, First Enoch, chapter 94. Now, my children, I say to you, love righteousness and walk therein. For the ways of righteousness are worthy of being embraced, but the ways of wickedness shall soon perish and diminish. Woe unto those who build oppression and injustice, who lay foundations for deceit. They shall soon be demolished, and they shall have no peace. Woe unto you, O rich people, for you have put your trust in wealth. You shall ooze out of your riches, for you do not remember the Most High. In the days of your affluence you committed oppression. You have become ready for death, and for the day of darkness and the day of great judgment. Chapter 96. Be hopeful, you righteous ones. In the day of tribulation your children shall be raised up high, and be made openly visible like eagles. Higher than the vultures will your dwelling place be. You shall ascend and enter the crevices of the earth and the clefts of the rock forever. Like squirrels before the face of the oppressors, the sirens shall be blown over you, wailing like the buzzing of wild bees. You who have experienced pain, fear not, for there shall be a healing medicine for you. A bright light shall shine, it shall enlighten you, and a voice of rest you shall hear from heaven. Woe unto you, O powerful people, you who coerce the righteous with your power. The day of your destruction is coming. In those days, at the time of your condemnation, many and good days will come for the righteous ones. Chapter 97, verse 1. Be confident, you righteous ones, for the sinners are due for a shame. They shall perish on the day of the judgment of oppression. Chapter 100. The angels will descend, going down into the hidden places on that day, and those who aided iniquity will be gathered into one place, and the Most High will be aroused on that day to execute great judgment on all. He will set a guard of the holy angels over all the righteous and holy, and they will be kept as the apple of the eye until evil and sin come to an end. And from that time the pious will sleep a sweet sleep, and there will no longer be anyone to frighten them. Woe to you, all you sinners, because of the words of your mouth and the deeds of your hands, in the heat of a blazing fire you will burn. Please share a word or a phrase. No, I'm kidding. I included these passages from Enoch in order to shed light on the gospel that Jesus is preaching in Matthew. Most Christians are not aware of the importance of this document for understanding the mission and message of Jesus. It connects Old and New Testaments in significant ways, which makes sense because it came after the Old Testament and before the time of Jesus. It was written in the 2nd century BCE. Enoch is a character from the book of Genesis, an ancestor of Noah, who built the ark that survived the great flood. Not much is said about Enoch in Genesis, but what is said is especially tantalizing, as it says he lived 365 years but did not actually die because, and I quote, God took him. This mysterious divine abduction inspired a lot of midrash on Enoch. Midrash is a Hebrew word that refers to a work of literature that serves to elaborate on or interpret a sacred story. The Book of Enoch is basically fan fiction for the book of Genesis. In the book named after him, Enoch is portrayed as a wizard-like figure who is shown by God all the mysteries of the cosmos, including the whole stretch of history from creation to the end of days. Enoch's prophecies concerning the day of judgment greatly shaped Jesus' own understanding of God's plans for the future. The references here in Matthew 13 to angels separating the righteous from the wicked, casting the latter into a furnace of fire, echo what is repeated throughout the book of Enoch. But why I think it's important to read the book of Enoch is because its visions of the day of judgment are especially vivid and fleshed out. The quotations we have from Jesus on the matter are much shorter by comparison. So Enoch helps us understand more of the meaning of these apocalyptic prophecies. Specifically, Enoch illustrates the extent to which these prophecies are about revolution, about liberating the oppressed and neutralizing oppressors. It's the rich and powerful who are the objects of God's vengeance, and the text serves to encourage you who have experienced pain. One through line that really strikes me is the transvaluation of values. Now, this is a big fancy phrase that was used by philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche to refer to the way oppressed people subvert the cultural standards of their oppressors. What the oppressors deem valuable and good, the oppressed condemn as wicked, and what the oppressors scorn, the oppressed exalt. In his description of the kingdom of heaven, I'm struck by Jesus' reference to merchants and treasure. At first glance, one might wonder why he is comparing heaven to such material things. But consider the larger point. The kingdom of heaven is worth sacrificing everything you have. Someone sells all that he has, it says, in order to obtain the field where the treasure of heaven lies buried. A merchant gives up all his possessions to obtain the one pearl of great value. And it was reflecting on this element of sacrifice that led to my conversation prompt. What is something you wanted so much that you sacrificed a great deal to get it? For me, it was when I left home for Regent University in Virginia to major in English with an emphasis on creative writing. I had struggled to determine what subject I should study. Part of me wanted to go to school for film production. Another part of me wanted to pursue a degree in music. Yet another wanted to pursue investigative journalism. But ultimately, it was my father's suggestion to major in English, citing the fact that I had been writing since I was a kid. I saved my first attempts at fiction writing on a floppy disk. And so I went to Regent as an English major, and that's how I met Debbie, who was also an English major. Except in my first Old Testament class, my professor Bill Lyons brought the Bible to life for me in ways I had never encountered growing up. Regent was a Christian school. We studied the Bible at Regent, just to decide. It's like, Old Testament class, that doesn't sound like evolution. He has a deep appreciation for the books of the Bible as works of literature. And he passed that appreciation of the Bible as a work of literature onto me. So by my second year, my major had changed to biblical and theological studies. This is a great example of my ADHD obsessiveness, how I go hook, line, and sinker into something that really interests me. I've always been that way. I get really excited about a new field of study or instrument or form of art, and I make it my whole world for a good long while. And that has, doing that for years and years has made me the very unstable, crazy person that I am. But it has also meant I have been driven my whole adult life more by my interests and passions than by instincts of frugality, long-term planning, or even survival. And I don't really know any other way to live. Recently, a friend made an observation to Debbie and I that we are the kinds of people who have chosen values and passion over financial security and career stability. And then he asked straightforwardly, Was that the right choice? It's just looking around at my life like, was that the right choice? Look at your life. At first, I wanted to say, I have no choice. I can't live any other way. Because I couldn't bear to spend most of my life working on something I'm not passionate about. But it's also not quite as simple as that. I have had to take on a lot of less desirable work in order to make ends meet. And I continually have to choose between what I want to do and what I need to do to survive. Of course, the NYPD would be interrupting my sermon. Just. Okay. Where was I on this page? ADHD. So I dug deeper into the question. If the question is following your passion the right choice if you want to avoid struggle and no reliable happiness, then certainly the answer is no. But if the question is a life spent doing what I love the one pearl of great price? Is it worth the sacrifice? Is it worthy of being embraced, as the text says? Then my answer is yes. That's not to say that my answer is always yes. Sometimes I get exceptionally forlorn and despairing about my circumstances. And sometimes I even feel like life isn't worth living at all. And the price is indeed high. 3 days a week, I walk dogs from morning to evening in rain or snow or, like last week, blistering heat. I put sunscreen on like every 90 minutes and get like someone made a comment about it. I was like, what, are we not all doing this? I pick up an immeasurable amount of dog shit. Just lots, just tons and tons. If you added it all together, it would be taller than my building. And when I'm not dog walking, ideally I'm dog sitting to compensate for the days that I have off. And often between creative projects and pet care, I am incredibly busy and stretched painfully thin. Some months I don't get extra gigs and so fail to make enough to pay the bills. Taxes are an absolute nightmare and a reliable source of anxiety. And I have to sell all kinds of things continually in order to ease the burden. But I love dogs. I love every dog I care for. And I enjoy their quirks and idiosyncrasies. I love befriending them and learning their special modes of communication. I love being someone they can trust and feel secure around. I love seeing the euphoria and gratitude in their faces when I give them a good neck massage. I should basically be like a professional dog masseuse. It would be. I love how excited they get when it's time to go explore outside. And I love that this is how I make a living. And I love the time it affords me to create and make what is in me to make. I've been offered higher paying jobs with health insurance and a path to a 6-figure salary. I could be applying to an array of positions that pay more and offer greater stability. But for me, working a 40-hour-a-week job is a lot of weeping and gnashing of teeth. I would much rather hang out with Hanzo, Laszlo, Remy, Munch, Walt, or one of my many other dogs. I don't know for sure if I'm making the right choice. And I wouldn't say that whoever has chosen stability over passion is not leading a life worthwhile. In fact, if I could mentally and emotionally handle a full-time provisional job, I might very well make the same choice. But 40 hours a week is a lot of fucking time. It's too much time, but I'll leave the 4-day work week issue to another day. I'll just say 40 hours is too much time for me to dedicate to someone else's vision, because I have too many visions of my own. I don't know if there is a right choice. As always, we just do the best with the choice we made. But I think it's good to stop and ask, what are we building week after week, day in and day out? What are we spending that 40 hours a week doing? What kind of world are we producing? In our capitalist culture, we inherit a lot of toxic ideas about work. We are expected to invest our hearts and souls into it. We get op-eds deriding silent quitting and diatribes from managers about how we shouldn't be in it just for the money. Corporations want us to give our all, to make the meaning of our lives about fulfilling their vision. But Jesus and Enoch remind us that there are things worth far more than money and that eclipse corporate values. Woe unto those who build oppression and injustice, the text says. For oppression and injustice are built. They are produced and sustained by human activity. They are made possible by a million compromises and by continually sacrificing moral, aesthetic, and personal values. So we should ask ourselves, what am I building? What am I spending most of my time working toward? And what am I sacrificing to do it? And am I working toward the kind of world I want to help build? Love righteousness and walk therein, for the way of righteousness is worthy of being embraced. So I ask myself, is the life I lead worthy of my embrace? Is the work I do worthy of my time?